We went to slide 51 in the PowerPoint for part one. Well, tonight we ended at 51, so we're going to go ahead and start from slide 51 and finish the rest of the presentation. So now we're going to start getting into some of the more complex aspects of solid fuels and how they burn. So we looked at the simple ones. Now we're going to start going into looking at some of the more complex. So here we have cellulosic and other natural materials. Combustion of dry woods, net heat of combustion is approximately 18 kilojoules per gram of the volatiles. So when we talk about heat of combustion, we're talking about the vaporous portion, the flaming portion of it, when we talk about that. And then if we take into consideration as it's smoldering, that's about 30 kilojoules when it's in the smoldering state. Natural materials have high protein content, so your animal products, you know, the peptides and so forth in it, wools, animal products. So thermal decomposition of products emits diverse gases. So remember, we talked about products, right? Can be more than one material involved. Generally less flammable than cellulosic material. So the protein-based things like wool and stuff like that generally aren't as easily ignitable as, let's say, cotton is. So that's where we left off on that, right? That's where we ended with, so I just wanted to tie that in. And now we're going to get into the synthetic polymers. So we have a monomer, a small molecule that can combine with other molecules to form a repeating chain molecule or a polymer. So a polymer is a linking of the monomers, the single molecular building block that we, and in synthetic fuel, solid fuel types, they can be very simple or they can be very complex, and then they're linked. So there's a thing called in the fire process, it's called runaway polymerization. And that's where the polymers start linking in a very rapid fashion. And if they start linking too quickly, they can combust, literally explosively. So has anybody worked with fiberglass? You know, so there's a catalyst or resins. Anybody work with resins? So there's a thing called a catalyst, right? And that's what will make a resin or the resin in fiberglass harden. But if you put too much catalyst into the mixture, it will smoke and the polymers will start linking together, and it produces a lot of heat and can cause combustion, or they can explode. And then an oligomer is a molecule consisting of a few monomer units. Polymers can be sorted by addition and condensation polymers, linear, branched, or cross-linked polymers, homopolymer or copolymer, thermoplastic, thermoset, and elastomeric polymers. So these are the basic fuels that we are going to encounter in the field. So a thermoplastic is like polystyrene, like your soda bottles and stuff like that, milk bottles, polyethylene plastics. So they're easily recyclable. But a thermoset plastic, once it is set, it cannot be redone. It takes a set, and then those are the kind of plastics that will burn or char and be burned like Class A materials. Whereas a thermoplastic will behave when it's burning like a Class B material. What's that?
What would be an example?
A thermoplastic, polystyrene, like these Coke bottles, okay? Thermoset plastic would be polyvinyl chloride, PVC pipe, some of the ABSs, formica, so like the top of this tabletop, that would be a thermoset plastic. Meaning as it burns, it'll have a tendency to char. And then, of course, elastomerics are the polymers are the ones that are very... They call them elastomeric because they have the modals of elasticity in them, meaning that they can flex and bend and not come apart. So addition polymers are just as the name implies, addition. So these addition polymers are built as successive monomeric units without elimination of any of the molecule or fragment. So they're building blocks, and none of the atoms or anything that build these building blocks are stripped away in order for them to combine with the other molecules. Where some of them, their addition or whatever, they'll combine at the front and form a whole other molecule to link them. Monomer or additional polymer has a carbon to carbon double bond is typical, and then of course your vinyl polymers or the vinyl plastics are notorious for that. And pretty soon we'll take a look at some of the Lewis structure of some of these polymetric bonds and structures.
What's a vinyl plastic?
A vinyl plastic is, you know, like a swimming pool, you know, like a Doughboy swimming pool. You know, like, and also too, you know, like your vinyl, you know, the windows that you see in the new buildings, those are, they call them, they're vinyl. It's a very durable plastic. And so that is what a vinyl is. It could be rigid or it could be highly flexible. So if we take a look at this, here it's just showing you some addition polymers, right? X is the pendant group, and then the resulting polymer. So here, this is the building block for polyethylene. So like milk bottles and stuff like that, like your water bottle right there, that's probably a polyethylene-based plastic. Then you have polypropylene, which is some of the material that we wear, you know, performance stuff, you know, for hiking or biking or what have you. Polystyrene, you know, this CD case is a polystyrene. A lot of the clear water bottles and Coke and soft drink bottles are of this material. Polyvinyl chloride, it has a chlorine atom added to the structure. So PVC pipe, those kind of things. And then polyacrylonate, this one here has a triple bond. The carbon is combining with a nitrogen atom. And then polyvinyl acetate. As you can see here, you have a double bond between the carbon and the oxygen. And then you see you have here, so this is showing you the structure linking with another polymer. So you just have to have a basic understanding of these.
No question for you.
Uh-huh.
And I apologize if you've already said this.
No.
When did they start discovering these different ethylene, polypropylene?
During the latter part of the original Industrial Revolution.
Okay.
So what started happening was the first plastics were Bakelite, and that was probably in the late 1800s, early 1900s in Germany. And then as they started playing around with chemical things, a lot of these were found by accident. They found, okay, these had certain properties and certain characteristics, so we can use them for certain aspects. And so they started getting more information and looking and being able to know what the building blocks were, they're able to manipulate the building blocks. So that's why you have a whole myriad of plastics. So addition polymers, we're still talking about that. Commercially important polymers formed from the vinyl polymers. Vinyl polymers can form a linear polymers. Cross-linking stabilizes the fire behavior of a polymer. So what that's saying is that the way they're in there, especially like polyvinyl chloride, so a lot of times there's a bromide component. It can be bromine, there can be fluorine, there can be chlorine added to these particular polymers. And the bromine is probably one of the strongest bond in organic chemistry. So that's why a lot of times you'll see the bromated, or what they call the bromated or chlorinated or fluorinated plastics are used because they add a lot of strength. And also too, when they burn, they produce some real toxic stuff, but if a fire source, like if I take a piece of polyvinyl chloride, I have a torch hit it, it'll burn, but when I take it away, it self-extinguishes. because remember how we talked about halogenated extinguishing agents, right? They attack the molecular structure of the, so if you have a direct heat source on it and a flame impingement, it'll kind of burn, but if that source is taken away, then the chain reaction breaks. So the part here, and a lot of when we have the fluorinated, bromated, and chlorinated polymers, we get this cross-linking, which stabilizes the fire behavior of the polymer, because it acts as roadblocks in the structure. Whereas if it didn't have that, that would just burn like the Dickens. So if we take a look at here, these are the Lewis structures of some of the basic common polymers that we see. Commercial, remember, just in the last slide we said they're impersonal, you know, usually polyvinyl based. So here's polyvinyl lidocaine chloride, PVCDC. So there's a building block. You have hydrogen to carbon, and then you have that double carbon bond between the two carbon atoms, and then you have a chlorine and a chlorine to that carbon. So you could see how they're cross-linking, and you could see how that would make it a very strong bond. When you have these double and triple bond in the structure, it makes for a very strong plastic. Polyfluoroethylene ethylene, PTFE. So a lot of times you see on containers for recycling, you'll see these symbols, and that's what they are. They're giving you the basic chemical structure. And here, this one, like the upper one above it, the PVCDC, this one now is the ethylene, but with fluorine added to it. So the fluorine bond is probably, that and the bromine, probably the strongest bonds you'll find in organic chemistry. Polyisobutylene, or PIB. Now you can see here, this one is severely cross-linked, right? And these are the double bond carbon, and then the single bond to two carbons, and then so that's a very cross-linked, very strong polymer in its own right. And then acrylic plastic, so like basically plexiglass, is this structure here. And then polymethylene or POM, or polyacetal, and then polyethylene oxide, PEO. And then so you could just see. So again, my point is these particular fuels are very complex. So that's why the solid fuels need, that's why I broke it into two components, because there's an awful lot of information here. So addition polymers. So we have diethylic alcohol and diisoacrinate. And then so if you take that polymer and add it together, see how they form? So look what happens to the OH radical. It's broken. The oxygen is stripped and is a double bond to the carbon, and then the N and the hydrogen are combined. And then if we take it even further, a urethane and then polyurethane, look what happens. You have three nitrogen atoms interlinking in that octagonal ring that forms the basis of this polymer, and then you have the other components hooked to it. So that's why sometimes you'll find a polyurethane either rigid or flexible. So like in the station fire, that was very flexible. You know, the packing foam is, and then you have that rigid polyurethane foam, you know, it has that the aluminum back and the rigid insulation, that would be rigid polyurethane foam. And so that's how some of these form. Like this one right here would be probably this would be the component that would make the polyurethane rigid. So there are three modes of addition polymer decomposition. Okay, so now we looked at the building blocks of how they're good. Double bonds, triple bonds, and so forth. But now, when they decompose, so when we add heat to it and fire to it, there's ways that they come apart. So we have unzipping. Literally, it's like a zipper on your coat. You know, so the polymers are put together, especially with your addition polymers. Then all of a sudden, you unzip your coat, so the polymers are being the molecular bonds are being broken, literally by unzipping, so hence the name. Random cessation, meaning that in the structure, especially with cross-linked polymers, they'll break at random spots and release their energy. And of course, elimination is where the polymer breaks into its component, smaller molecules, or breaks into atoms themselves in the process and will release heat. Other addition polymers are the amino acrylates, totally fluorinated polymers, polyurethanes, and isoacrylate cross-linked rigid foams. So that's that one we were looking at. The cross-linked foams are the rigid foams. Whenever you cross-link, and then typical addition polymers like regular polyurethane is very flexible, is what it's saying. Cross-link usually means rigid. So like when we say the definition of a thermosetting plastic is cross-linked polymers that will char or burn, will char upon heating or burning. That's what makes it so rigid. So bakelite, one of the earliest plastics known, is a very rigid plastic. And the totally fluorinated polymers, these are the ones that are highly resistant to burning, because they have the fluorinated components to them, either chlorine or bromine or fluorine. So the halogenated agents are built on this premise. So they attack. So that's why, like I said, when you hit them with a torch, they'll flame. But once you take that flame away, they just go right out. So condensation polymers, hence the name, is exactly what it is. The polymers will condense onto themselves and form. Examples are neoprene and nylon. So neoprene is basically a synthetic rubber. And the nylon would be mimicking almost like a synthetic wool. Formed via elimination of small molecule each time another link is added to the polymer chain. Combinations of organic acids with alcohols and organic acids with the amines. So as these polymers are put together, one of the molecular units is broken so that they will link together. So that is that's the basic structure of that. So you can see how these form. All right, and how they form and how they burn gives you very specific characteristics. When they burn, you can say, okay, well, this decomposition is probably an unzipping type because of the nature of the way this polymetric structure of this particular plastic is formed. So, and that would give you that. So if we take a look at here's some condensation polymers. So we have the polyesters, polyamides, or the classic example. And if you see here, the one on the upper left showing the condensation polymer, it was showing you a polyester. You have the octagon form, a lot of double carbon bonds, and then with single hydrogen bonds. And then you see the double oxygen to the single carbon. This is why they're called condensation, because they condensate, just like water condensates on a cold surface. So as these, and they form, and they can be fairly simple, such as the polyesters as you see here. And then as you get in there, they can be more complex. As you can see, just by the nature of the double bonds and the octagonal structures forming, and the H and the O, and everything else. So you could just see. And then the polyamides are even more complex and and you can see how they structure. But see how they add? They're condensating to each other. They're linking to each other by condensation. But again, remember the one piece is eliminated in between to form that.
How would we know that, like, by looking at it, if they're forming together by condensation?
By the nature of what they are. So polyesters, polyamides, are condensation polymers. So what you do is it, by the name and the type of the polymer will give you an indication if it's a what type it is. Aramids are condensation polymers used to make protective gear. So remember last week I had the Kevlar, right? Or the Nomex. So the Nomex would be an aramid fiber. Thermoset polymers char when heated. So we talked about that. Commercial plastics are not pure polymers because chlorine or fluorine or some other inorganic compound may be added to it. So what happened when I was playing with that piece of Nomex? It burned, right? But when I took the torch away, what happened to it? It extinguished. Okay. Fire retardants, okay? So polyvinyl chloride is an example. So there's different type of, now we're gonna talk about retardants or fire inhibitors that are added to the various fuel types. So you should be familiar with the, you should be familiar with what type of process is added to a given fuel type to give you a specific kind of characteristic. So we have what we call polymetric materials that do not do well in fire tests are modified by the fire retardants. So a lot of these plastics, nylon, stuff like that, polyurethane, will burn like the dickens if they're left in their unmodified state. But if there's additives added to it, it could slow the fire process down. So that's, you'll see FRs. So chemical additive that slows the ignition and or burning rate of the material. FR chemicals are largely halogen compounds like we talked about. So bromine, fluorine, chlorine would be the halogen compounds. Provides resistance to small ignition sources. FR chemicals often added at a minimum level. So what they'll do is they'll add a small amount. So like a lot of your computer cabinets and stuff like that are of this type. So that if a small fire starts in there, they resist so they don't necessarily start burning. And then, you know, and then that's the, you know, the process with it. And that's because of the fluorinated or bromine or chlorine that's part of that plastic structure. Age can affect the product's fire resistance concentration. FR additives modify the ignition and burning rates of solid fuels through four mechanisms. One, it can promote char formation. So once you get char formation, the char formation will form an insulative layer, so it will shield it from radiant or convective heat components. So they'll act as an insulating layer, so that will cause inhibiting the spread of fire or slow it way down. Gas flame inhibition. So like polyvinyl chloride, these will go into a gaseous stage, and then what happens is the gases, remember the OH radicals, the chlorine or the fluorine will break that process, so you don't get the chain propagation reactions, and which are critical, or chain forming reactions, and to chain prop, it cuts those, especially the chain forming, which is the critical step. The OH radicals is the fundamental basic structure of that particular type of fire process. Solid phase heat absorption. So that happened, meaning that it will go into a solution, and then there'll be solid particles in there that will suck the heat away, so it doesn't get going very well. Or the product will absorb the heat and dissipate it in such a way that it doesn't allow it to mic, you know, because a lot of, remember, fire process with a lot of our solid fuels is the concentration bringing it to ignition temperature. So if you can keep it below ignition temperature by heat dissipation, then that's going to make it a lot harder to get. And then, of course, barrier formation. So some of these things, as they start burning, they'll form, like I said, the char, they'll form a chemical layer over something, and that layer will act as a barrier so that it stops the vaporization or the heat of gasification of that, or heat of vaporization if it's a thermoplastic, or heat of gasification if it's a thermoplastic, or and so forth. So let's talk a little bit about the application of fire-resistant additives. Woods are typically impregnated with inorganic salts to promote char formation. So some of the wood in fire, so that they don't go into the flaming and burn and produce a gas, they'll form a char, and then that char will form an insulative layer and help resist it to burn. That's why in structural environments, if I have a beam that is, let's say, 10 centimeters by 20 centimeters, and I had the same beam made out of steel, which one do you think is going to fail first under fire conditions? The steel or the wood? The steel is going to fail. Remember, we talked a little bit about that steel. And when it reaches 600 degrees Celsius, it will lose 50% of its structural integrity. Okay, well, what happens with heavy wood beam construction is that it forms that char. And then that char, it will burn eventually, but that char forms that insulative layer, so it slows it way down. So it will be, it has more fire resistance than the exposed steel does. So that's why you see a lot of exposed steel and structures will have like gunite or coating on it to insulate that steel so that it doesn't heat up and lose its structural integrity. Because remember, it doesn't take much. Cellulosic materials are filled with borax and or boric acid to reduce the tendency to smolder or flame. And so like the borax material was like a way of washing cotton clothes back in the day, borax-based detergents. You know, you'll see the thing, but it shows the borax strains coming out of like, you know, the desert, because that's what they use. Well, that's why they, you know, wash with, to keep it so, you know, you clean the clothes using that borax-based detergent. It makes it less apt for it to ignite and smolder, because cottons love to smolder.
Is there any similarities with, like, borax, Ajax, or anything, or is it?
Borax is basically boric acid in there, or borax, the mineral.
Yeah.
That's where it got its name. Yep, you got it. And rigid solid materials are coated with fire-resistant paints. So synthetic polymers are copolymerized with small proportions of bromine-containing monomers. So like the polyvinyl acetate, polyvinyl chloride, all these kind of things are with this. So vinyl polymers are fire-resistant through halogenated organic compounds and antimony oxide. So antimony is a heavy metal, and the oxide makes a very good building block to help break the OH radical production in the combustion process. So barrier material will slow or prevent passage of pyrolyzed material to fresh air. So that's why some of these materials, they'll burn, they might gasify for a bit, then the material that's added to it will form a barrier, and the production of vapor for the combustion process is severely limited. So composite materials and furnishings. Composite, a product consisting of more than one material. So what do you think of a composite? What would you think is a composite material? What in your mind, what would you think some of the things would be?
I've heard that so many times. Composite.
Okay, so particle board?
For sure.
Plywood? Because plywood will have the laminates, and then they'll have a resorcinol-based adhesive to hold the pieces together. Carbon fiber, right? You have carbon fiber with a resin matrix, yeah, right. And so forth. So that's what they mean by a composite material, meaning it's composed of more than one material. So you could have polyurethane, then you can have a piece of wood on top of it. That would be a composite material. Sheetrock is a composite material. You have the gypsum and you have the paper on it. So that's what a composite material, meaning more than one material makes up that building material, is what it's saying. So most commonly encountered combustible items are a composite of some form or another. This chair is a composite, right? You got the plastic, you got the leather. I mean, not the cloth, and then maybe a polyurethane underneath it. So, full-scale fire test with actual products, and realistic simulation of ignition source and radiative heat environment. So that's why we, with products, we do full-scale testing, because you have a material A, B, C, or A, B, C, D, E, F, G, H, A, D, K, M, the whole alphabet, in terms of the materials that can be make up a product. So that's why we will do full-scale testing, because to try and guess and this and that, because of the complexity of the various products burning all at once. So that's why we all do full-scale testing on these, to give us a better idea of what the energy yields are going to be from as these products burn. And materials, remember we talked about materials last week. Materials are usually small bench test. So like a piece of plywood or a piece of wood or a piece of plastic, a type of plastic, will burn small because we know we're burning basically a homogeneous material for the most part. But when you have a combination of wood, polyurethane, nylon covering or polyester covering, maybe polystyrene might be in there, you know, it could be a whole host of anything. And that's why you do the large scale burning, so that you can direct measure what it's doing exactly. No systematic measurements have been completed for the ease of flaming ignition for full scale combustibles. So what we do is we try and do things. So this is a location of covering, sheets of covered tests, upholstery fabric here to test things. So there's many different kind of tests depending on what we're dealing with to figure out how something ignites, how the fire progresses. So there's no real, like they were saying here, no real systematic measurements have been completed to easily calculate this. It's a very complex, to say the least. Calorimeters measure the burning rate of various time of certain furnishing items. Oxygen consumption calorimetry. Remember we talked about this before. What did we talk about last week? Limiting what? Oxygen index, right? So if we have a high limiting index, that means we're throttling down the oxygen component and seeing how it burns under varying ventilated conditions. So If it's a high level index, that means either it will ignite or not ignite. So certain materials, depending on what it is. So we know, like the Nomex we talked about last week, right? I lit. That would be under normal atmospheric conditions at 21%. That's considered a high limiting oxygen index for that material. And then what did I say about if I take that Nomex and I have it in a highly oxygenated environment, well, how will it burn? It will burn as if it were tissue paper. Okay? So depending on the material, so that's how we determine the flammability of material, is by playing around with its ventilation conditions. So Nomex, under normal oxygen environments, such as normal atmospheric conditions, it will self-extinguish. But in a highly oxygenated atmosphere, it will burn like the Dickens. And so this calorimeters measures this. So when we talk about burning rate, we're talking about the mass of that material or product, how much of it has actually been burned, reacted, oxidized, meaning into stable combustion products, CO2, water vapor, inorganic solids, right? Under normal combustion process, it cannot be broken down any further. So that's what this device does. So again, the oxygen consumption calorimeter is how much oxygen is given, and I think it's usually like 13.1 is the average for grams of oxygen consumed per gram of fuel. So underlying principle of oxygen consumption calorimetry is for all common combustibles is approximately 13.1 kilojoules of heat is released per gram of oxygen consumed. So this gives us a very good method of calculating, okay, we have this amount of grams, and we're going to get, so 13.1 kilojoules per gram of heat released per gram of oxygen consumed. So that calorimetry device is what does that for us. It will tell us how much consumption, how much is being consumed, how many grams per second are burning, and then that way you can figure out your energy yields. Basic required measurements in oxygen consumption calorimetry comprise continuous gas flow and temperature in the duct and oxygen concentration in that flow. So is it coming out, emanating through the exhaust to be measured by the sensors? That is what we use to calculate it. And we can vary it from burning in normal conditions to burning in highly oxygenated conditions or ventilation limited conditions. What the energy yields will be at various conditions that we would encounter in an environment.
So that 13.1 is a pretty consistent number,
yeah,
regardless of what the fuel is.
Yeah, this is this what this is, you know how we, whenever we do a guesstimate or something like that, we have a basic understanding. So by doing varying tests, this seems to be the typical average. So if you use this it's a good way to guesstimate what you're dealing with. It's a good means of in the field, okay, here's what's happening. So from their tests, this is what they, 13.1 kilojoules per gram heat released per gram of oxygen consumed. So 1 gram of oxygen being consumed and that product is burning, you're going to get about 13.1 kilojoules per gram of the fuel burning. The oxygen being added to that 1 gram. So it's almost like you're reaching almost stoichiometric, meaning that, you know, it's a fairly balanced. But then it can vary based upon the fuel type and the fire conditions. So if we take a look here, this is table 9.3 in your text. Typical heat release rates for various combustible items. So let's take a look. Mattress Foundation, US Twins, pre-2006. This is MW is megawatts, millions of watts of energy. Usually in excess of 2 megawatts for that. Mattress Foundation, US Twin, compliant with 16 CFR 1633. This is post 2006. 0.1 of a megawatt. Cathode ray tube television, which we don't see a whole lot anymore. Fire resistant plastic cabinet US. So the old TVs were like this. 0.2 megawatts. Unupholstered chair, polyurethane foam, polyethylene fabric, 2 megawatts. Upholstered chair, California TB133 compliant. Less than 0.08 megawatt. Stack of 6 steel frame polypropylene chairs, 1.9. Wooden dresser, 1.8 megawatts. Curtains, 2.13 meters by 1.25 meters, 0.13 to 1.2 megawatts. And so forth. An automobile, 1.2 to 8.3 megawatts, and then school bus 29 to 34. And the approximate time, so a bus is about 5,000 seconds, a car about 1,000 seconds, a wooden dresser 200, and then polypropylene chairs, and the others no real time stamp on them. But just to give you, this is to give you an idea how complex and why we do these full-scale tests so that we could derive and do these tables so that we can do some reasonable computations of how the process begins. Acid-base pairs, okay? Alkaline substances will react with any other acids, releasing substantial heat and possibly causing nearby materials to ignite. So most common alkalis are sodium hydroxide, lye, and calcium oxide, quicklime. So when these things start building in the heat, they could generate substantive heat and cause enough heat to cause any fuels in the area to combust. Okay, so let's talk a little bit about metals. Combustion of metals. Oxidation of metal is highly exothermic process. The thermal conductivity of metal is approximately 1,000 times that of most common organic polymers. And then the most dangerous are the combustible metal powders. Because once they get going, they burn very viciously, and if they become airborne and they're within their flammable range, they're very explosive. So thermobaric devices, military devices, are based on this premise. It could either be an aerosol of a like kerosene, or it could be a metal powder put into a dust form and then set off and ignite it, and it will overpressurize and incinerate everything in its path. So has anybody heard of Moab? The mother of all bombs, right? Well, that's what it was. Moab was a thermobaric device. And so when that last phase, when the troops with the Iraq, whole armored division surrendered. Because you drop a Moab on top of a troop concentration or even armored formation, it will devastate it. A Moab could devastate one city block in one blast. And everything within that zone is crushed. And if you're in something, you think you're in a bunker or whatever, it'll suck all the oxygen out of the atmosphere and just cook everything. So that was the biggest thermobaric device. And the Russians were the first to apply the thermobaric device to RPG rocket launchers. They put a device on there, it's a thermobaric, and so for firing into caves in Afghanistan. They would fire them into the caves or cave complexes or in buildings, and they'd go inside and then pop and then overpressurize and just cause a massive blast wave. So if the oxygen being suffocated didn't get you, the blast effect would just crush you. Like a ketchup packet, somebody stepping on a ketchup packet in a restaurant. When we were kids, we used to do stupid things like that.
Ketchup bombs.
Yep. So, if we take a look at the thermal conductivity metal is 1,000 times that of most common organic polymers, meaning that most metals are very difficult to start on fire, because what's going to happen, the heat hits it and then it's going to conduct it away and then radiate it out most of the part. But if there's enough of a process, it can get going very well. So, case in point. Magnesium, right? Very, very combustible metal. But this is conducting the heat away so quick, I can do almost all day. But now if I take the same magnesium, and whenever you take metal and you put it into, it becomes particles or small shavings or anything else like that. Alright, so you can see here magnesium shavings. Oh.
Run!
It just blew it away. I just have to do is. So, what I'll do is it was just too much force, but if I burn the paper. Now you'll see the fire will get towards the magnesium, and watch what happens to the magnesium. It's See how quickly that ignited? Okay. So it doesn't take much impetus to ignite it. And the thing that's unique about magnesium or the combustible metals is that if you try and use water to put them out, or that fire extinguisher over here, you notice how they call this a tri-class extinguisher. So you'll notice on here, this extinguisher says class A, class B, and class C. What's a metal called?
Class D.
A class D. So, if you use this tri-class extinguisher on a metal fire, you're adding fuel to the fire. So this is inert compared under normal combustion processes. But again, this burns so hot, it breaks the molecular bonds of water. So that's why if you throw water on a combustible metal, you usually see it literally explode, because it's stripping the hydrogen and the hydrogen from the oxygen molecule, and then the hydrogen acts as a fuel and the oxygen acts as an oxidizer. So that's why you don't want to use that on your class D material for that particular reason. So metals are generally very, very hard to get to go. But if they're small particles, so like a lot of times if I concentrate enough heat on this edge, like if I had an oxyacetylene torch and I hit this top part here and got that going, yeah, it would just start burning and this one would just start to spread. So like GM, Volkswagen, all those, they use a lot of the magnesium alloys. Go ahead and pass that around. You'll feel it's very light. So they'll use aluminum magnesium alloy, which is highly combustible. But you notice how light that is. Or if that was a steel rod, that it would weigh probably 3 to 4 times that what that weighs.
So when you do the metal shavings, is that more on the principles of
surface area? Yep. Yeah, so I had the surface area, so when that small amount of heat hit it, it brought it up to its ignition temperature. Whereas on the big piece, I hit it with the same amount of heat, and what happens is the metal, again, is 1,000 times more conductive than this. So that's why this cellulosic material, polymetric materials ignite, because they will retain the heat and they'll reach their ignition temperature fairly quickly. Whereas with the metals, it dissipates it. But if you're fine particles or fine shavings, they'll ignite very easily and they burn very, very aggressively. So if we take a look at here, this is table 9-4. Metals that burn on their surface and metals that burn on their vapor. So you're going to need to know on the quiz, there's going to probably be questions on what metal burns in a vapor state and which burn on and what we call a surface combustion. So if you take a look, silicon, titanium, boron, and zirconium, these burn on the surface. So they almost look like they're charring. Okay? Potassium, sodium, magnesium, which we just burned in class, that was burns in a vaporous stage. It burns, you know, it has a flame to it. Lithium vapor, calcium vapor, aluminum vapor. So the alkaline metals and the magnesium and aluminum will all burn in the vapor stage. Zirconium, boron, titanium, and silicon will burn on the surface. And then, of course, these are your Kelvin temperatures of what it takes to get them to go. So you can see it takes an awful lot of energy for these to take off. But once that's been reached, then it's going to take off big time. So that's why we call extinguishers, in most cases, is dry chem. So it distinguishes it from that, and dry powder extinguishers denote a class D extinguisher. So that is why that distinction is made, so that you're not confusing. You're not confusing dry powder, which would be used on class D, with a dry chem, which is used on either class A, B, or C, or B and C, or, you know, because dry class is the most common, usually a monoammonium phosphate, which attacks the fire process via chemical chain breaking. So again, so remember, so the metals will burn either on their surface, or they'll burn in the vaporous, in the vapor phase. So some metals, again, the zirconium, boron, titanium, silicon, or surface burners, potassium, sodium, magnesium, lithium, calcium, and aluminum, or vapor when they burn. So flame temperature of a metal is limited by the boiling point of that metal, of its oxide. Hot metals can react rapidly exothermically with water to form hydrogen. So let's say if you have this, this is the aluminum, plus 3H2O liquid, goes to Al2O3 plus 3H2, which that's the part that makes it very reactive. That's what makes the fire like literally explode. And then plus 819 kilojoules per gram. So that is a lot of energy. So that main thing with the metal and the water and with water, it produces huge amounts of hydrogen. Magnesium cannot ignite under some conditions at 932 degrees Fahrenheit. Some magnesium alloys have lower ignition temperatures. Molten magnesium in contact with iron oxide produces a highly energetic thermite reaction. Has anybody heard of a thermite device? There's a thermite torch, you know, for cutting through steel plate. It burns so hot that it'll cut right through that. I got to see if I have that video clip in here. Go ahead.
What's the comparison from thermite to plasma? Is that close?
Thermite is iron oxide and aluminum powder. And so what it does is it makes a very energetic chemical process. So that's what this was showing you right here. This is showing magnesium, but thermite is aluminum powder and iron oxide, because the iron oxide has the oxygen component in the iron oxide itself, and then the aluminum, they get going, they get burning. I'll try and bring up a clip when we do here. Bring up some clips. I have the classic thing from an English show. It's pretty funny, so I'll bring that up, showing you what thermite does. Finally, divided magnesium burns in an atmosphere of any of the following pure gases to yield. Steam will produce magnesium oxide plus hydrogen, which makes the matters worse. Carbon dioxide will break it down and produce magnesium oxide plus carbon monoxide. Nitrogen and two, and halogenated agents will only make matters worse. As you can see here, fluorine, bromine compounds. So it turns it very toxic as well. So now what we're going to do is we're going to take a look at some types of metals, how they burn, and what characteristics to expect. Aluminum, higher boiling point. Powder is used in solid propellant rocket fuels. Powder reacts violently with halogenated liquids, common solvents, and fire suppressants. So that's why you don't want to have any of those come near here, because it causes a massive exothermic reaction. Almost becomes pyrophoric with these materials. Reacts with iron oxide in a thermite reaction to produce temperatures high enough to melt steel. Will not burn in nitrogen atmosphere. Iron and steel can burn in pure oxygen. Fine steel wool or steel dust can ignite. Massive pieces of titanium generally cannot be ignited because they're such a thermal sink, they'll dissipate before they can get to that. Fine turnings or thin chips will burn vigorously of titanium. And titanium dust clouds can ignite explosively. Alkali metals, lithium, sodium, potassium have very low melting points. On contact with water at room temperature, sodium and potassium generate hydrogen exothermically and burst into flame spontaneously. Alkali metals can be ignited by heating in dry air. Lithium can burn in pure nitrogen. So depending on the type of metal you have, you think you could, I'm going to flood it with nitrogen to inert the atmosphere with lithium, it only makes matters worse. So that's why you have to know what you have and how these will react. So NK, which is a combination of sodium and potassium, an alloy with a low melting point used in heat transfer fluid. So some of the nuclear reactors that Russia used, they used these what they call the liquid metal reactors, which is very stupid, very dumb, and they've had a lot of their submarines go down to the bottom or blow up because of you get a breach in the closed system and it gets exposed to air and it just turns into a massive fire. And the fire properties resemble that of sodium and potassium burning together. Very, very nasty. Exothermic materials. A material can undergo chemical reaction and releases heat without an additional oxidizer, such as oxygen from the air. Easier ignition, faster fire growth, higher flame temperatures, more difficult to extinguish. So that's what they mean by the oxidizing unit, the oxidizing component is built into it. Or it will suck oxygen from the environment. Even like if it's CO2 or whatever, it will strip it. Heat release process. These materials are generally thermal instability. Self-polymerization. Remember I talked about earlier how the polymers will start combining and linking together. Intermolecular oxidation reduction. So what that means is they're self-oxidizing. Oxidizing agent in contact with a reducing agent all in one. So that's why we call these exothermic materials, because they have the various components depending on how they're configured, and they'll easily ignite. That's why they're highly unstable. Because they don't need to have the input of atmospheric oxygen for them to kick off on you. Oxidizers might get mixed with common materials and react exothermically. Common classes: nitric acid and salts. Perchlorate acids and salts. So remember we talked about perchlorate last time in fireworks? Is a common one. Chromic acid and salts. Permanganate acids and salts. So all of these particular are oxidizers, meaning that there's oxygen built into them. So the perchlorates are highly reactive. So if they get combined with a reducing agent, which is the fuel. So when you see oxidizing agent and reducing agent would be, you know, the paper or whatever fuel that you have. So let's take a look at ANFO, ammonium nitrate fuel oil explosive. You have ammonium nitrate, right? And you have kerosene or diesel or bunker oil or what have you that make up that. So if it gets the proper stimuli and it ignites explosively, detonation actually. So because ammonium nitrate has the oxidizing component in it, and then it's reacting with the reducing agent, which is the fuel being the oil compound of that explosive. Just to give you an example. So let's look at some common classes. Fluorine, chlorine, bromine, and iodine are very reactive. Matter of fact, pure fluorine combined with glass is pyrophoric. It will auto-ignite on you. So pure fluorine in glass, they will burn. You have the inorganic peroxide, so the hydrogen peroxide, for instance, is an example. Highly, in certain concentrations, it's highly reactive. Calcium hyperchlorite, which is very volatile, used in explosive. Potassium persulfate, manganese dioxide, chlorate, bromate, and iodide salts are highly reactive. So if these get combined with organic compounds, they burn very vigorously and can, in some cases, burn explosively.
Is there any difference when you use the words active, reactive, or volatile?
They're kind of used. Volatile can mean not necessarily chemically volatile. So like the gasoline is volatile. I mean, it will go into a gaseous stage and go into a flammable mixture, and that's what we call how easily it boils off. And reactive is just simply saying that if, like oxygen, right? Pure oxygen in its own self will not burn. Ammonium nitrate, you try and put a torch to it, it will not burn. But if I take ammonium nitrate and mix it with sawdust and light it off, and I put in a cover over it, like we did with the candle. Remember, I took the candle and we extinguished the candle?
Yes.
It will, in that environment, it will burn. It could be totally deprived of oxygen. That's like rocket fuel is, you know, like could be perchlorate or alcohol. The Germans use the stuff called T-stoff and C-stoff, hydrazine with alcohol or kerosene-based compound for the rocket fighters. And very volatile, it will burn in outer space. So that's why that's like these peroxides and persulfates. And remember, we looked at that rocket factory, was, I believe, a perchlorate based solid fuel, and how that exploded. So to summarize, so we're going to do a quick summary, and then we'll take a quick break, then we'll come back, we'll take a look at some video clips, and then we'll do the class and the class activity. So the pyrolysis of a solid to form gaseous fragments can be characterized by heat of gasification. So there's heat of vaporization and heat of gasification. So heat of gasification is a chemical change, where heat of vaporization is simply turning a liquid into a vapor state without altering it chemically. Or taking a thermoplastic and turning it to a liquid and then putting it into a vapor, but the chemical structure is still the same. During pyrolysis, chemical change occurs within that solid. So the vapors coming off of it are totally chemically different than the parent material that generated them. The ignition of pyrolytic compounds from a solid is similar to that ignition of gaseous vapors, except the heat loss from the fuel surface to the interior of the surroundings can delay or prevent ignition. So remember, that's why solid fuels are not as hazardous as the general solid fuels, such as paper and normal plastics. They're not as hazardous as liquids, because if you have to have a certain minimum temperature in order to support that process. For fuel to smolder or self-heat, it must be porous. Its interior surfaces must react exothermically with oxygen, and the material must be a good insulator. So cotton rags, wood, all these are very highly insulative materials. They're going to retain the heat. So the bigger the pile of rags, let's say oily rags, the greater the chance for them to ignite. So the bigger the fuel array, the more heat it's going to retain, and the chances of it igniting are going to be greater than a smaller fuel array. In terms of self-heating and spontaneous combustion, I'm referring to. Surface char formation slows burning by insulating the subsurface materials from the flame radiation and sequestering carbon. So the carbon is being locked into the char. So remember that carbon, so the hydrocarbon component is very important to form the OH radicals. For solids that melt during burning, dripping or running of the liquid increases the fire spread rate due to the increase in burning surface. The flaming liquid can also ignite other combustibles upon contact. The burning rate depends on the radiant flux to the surface. Early in a fire, the flux comes from the local flames. Most of the flux is derived from the hot surroundings. So in a flashover condition in a compartment fire, you have the ceiling layer radiating to the fuel packages in that room, causing the issue. Flame spread rate depends on whether the spread direction is upward, fastest. So if I, like on this screen, if I start the screen and light the fire at the bottom as it goes up, because the wind direction and the flame direction are going in the same direction, so it's going to be much faster, that vertical. And it's slow when it's going laterally or burning down. So if the fire is burning downwards and the wind is, and the airflow is coming from the bottom up, it's slow, like we demonstrated last week. Also, fires can intensify if we have a fuel that is dripping when it occurs, or degree of radiative preheating, the thermal thickness of the solid. So if it's a thin material, we know it's going to ignite quite quickly, whereas a thick material, it's going to take a lot longer, as we demonstrated last week with the balsa wood examples, right? The thin one burned up there. I hit the thick piece, it burned, caught fire, and then when I took the torch away, what happened? It went out. Nearly all common solid combustibles are polymers, which consist of strings of identical building blocks. Polymers are classified based on whether they are formed by addition, polymers by condensation, synthesized by nature, or by humans. Linear cross-linked, composed of single building blocks or multiple building blocks of a thermoplastic or thermoset or elastomeric, or the various types of cross-linking. Many formulations of each of the family of plastics exist, as do many types of woods. The burning properties of these solid combustibles vary considerably depending on what their chemical makeup is. Fire retardants are added to combustible materials to help them meet flammability criteria. These additives work by promoting either char formation, inhibiting the flame chemistry, or absorbing heat in the solid, and or forming a barrier between the flame and the surface. So like polyvinyl chloride, they'll form a char, and that's why when you take the torch away, they kind of go out. Most common combustible items consist of multiple materials. We cannot yet quantify the fire behavior of a composite from its constituent materials. Instead, the fire performance is measured by burning an entire item or product, or estimated from tests of small specimens of the materials and doing an aggregate analysis. But again, we usually like to do direct measurement. A lot more accurate. Oxygen consumption calorimetry is the tool for determining the rate of heat release of a product or specimens from a product. Exothermic materials and finely divided materials pose unusually and potentially severe fire hazards, but are found amongst most exclusively in non-residential settings. So you'll see these in mostly industrial processes. Are there any questions on the presentation from tonight or anything from last week before we take a short break? Elastomeric polymer would be, have you ever seen an elastomeric paint? Mm-hmm. Okay, how it's very flexible. Mm-hmm. It can expand and contract and not fall apart. In other words, it's a plastic material that has what we call high modals of elasticity, meaning that it can stretch and bend in many, many cycles before it fails. So that's why, like most of the houses and everything else, you'll see elastomeric paint used, especially on old stucco houses, for that reason, because it can expand and contract with the stucco being heated and maintain that moisture barrier, that, or if you just try and use regular latex paint and all that kind of stuff, not going to be very durable. So that's why you'll see elastomeric paints used on those kind of, you know, concrete, stucco type structures, plaster, and so forth, that are exposed to temperature extremes. Any other questions before we take a short break? All right.